Hello, awesome people. Welcome to Embrace the Pivot. I'm Dr. C. Robinson, your host for the show. Join me as we discover what pivoting actually means and how you can embrace your pivot during life's transition. Happy Wednesday, everyone. I hope all of you are having a great week so far. Today's guest is really special to me. I believe I shared the story with you about how I learned how to rebrand myself and how to introduce myself when I'm networking or connecting with someone. Today's guest is the person who helped me with that. I know him as Professor Squires. He goes by Bill or Squires, but I like to call him Professor Squires. He was one of my professors at Columbia University in the Sports Management Master's Program. He taught the Facilities course, which was by far one of my favorite courses. We even got to go to a game, go into the commissioner's suite, I believe it was called, and watch the game from there, but also shadowing people from the stadium to learn what they do, how they do it, and all the hard work that goes into producing a sports game. A lot of us just watch it from TV and we don't realize everything that goes on behind the scenes. And Professor Squires was able to show us that, show us everything, every minute detail that goes into it. And over the years, we've remained in touch and I like to call him a friend now. He has an incredible story into how he got into the sports industry. And it just goes to show that some of your best experiences are those that are unexpected. You can plan as much as you want for a pivot and to pivot. Sometimes life has other plans for you and you have to adjust your strategy. And it also comes down to asking for what you want. My conversation with Bill today goes into his biggest career pivot, how he got there, and also how he helped me rebrand myself and how I now introduce myself when I am connecting with people. Squires currently has his own consulting business featuring clients such as the New York Football Giants. Bill is the liaison between the team and the new Meadowlands Stadium Company, which operates the $1.6 billion MetLife Stadium. Many of his other clients provide products and services to the sports facility industry. He also works as an expert witness in lawsuits that involve sports teams and venues. He is a member of the Sports League Sports Council, which works with the Department of Homeland Security on security issues involving the safety and security of sports and entertainment venues. He is a graduate of the United States Naval Academy and served on active duty as a naval aviator for 12 years before joining the Naval Reserves. That is just a snapshot into his career. He has pivoted many times, has worked with some of the most incredible people in sports, and is just one of the most genuine people I have ever met. Please welcome Bill to this episode of Embrace the Pivot.
Well, Cheryl, it's a pleasure and honor. Thank you for having me.
Okay, you have had a very interesting and eclectic career. So what I would like to know is, what do you deem the biggest career pivot for you?
Well, I know that you're going to present my bio, but I think something you might mention is that I served the United States Navy as a naval aviator for 12 years. I really thought I was going to make it a career until I had an extraordinary opportunity to work for the New York Yankees. And when I was offered the position, very, 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 very difficult decision for me to make. Because I really loved what I was doing in the Navy. I knew I was making a difference, and I wanted to serve. But I also knew that if I took a civilian job with the Yankees, I could remain in the reserves, naval reserves, and still contribute, in the defense of our country. So that was a unique pivot. I've had a lot of people ask me when they find out that I was a Navy pilot at one time, and now I work in the world of sports, how in the heck did that happen? And it's a, I think it's a pretty good life lesson for, you know, how I went about and made that decision.
All right. So Cher, how did you go from naval aviator to the Yankees?
I was on an aircraft carrier, the USS John F. Kennedy, which was, you know, I was a communications officer, and I knew in January of 1986 that we'd be heading to Fort Lauderdale, Florida for a 4-day called R&R, rest and relaxation period. We'd pull into Port Everglades and, you know, enjoy the sights and sounds of Fort Lauderdale. But as a young man, as a huge Yankee fan growing up, somebody who played baseball in high school and college, I was a left-handed pitcher and a big fan of the Yankees. I knew that they had their spring training site in Fort Lauderdale. So I've always taken a little bit of initiative when there's something that I think that would be fun to do and maybe benefit others. And with the permission of my commanding officer, I reached out to New York Yankees and asked if I could get tickets for the spring training game. The individual I spoke with said, well, you know, we don't give tickets away. We're a business. We sell tickets. And I said, I understand that, but if you could ask Mr. George M. Steinbrenner III, the owner of the Yankees, if he'd be willing to donate the tickets, I think he might strongly consider it. And then I asked him, I said, we'd also like to reciprocate by having the Yankees ownership, families, coaches, players come out to the John F. Kennedy for a tour. I mean, not many people get an opportunity to go aboard an aircraft carrier and get a behind the scenes tour.
Right.
And the gentleman responded, well, you know, we're down here to work out and get in shape and getting ready for the season. But I also knew at that time of the year, they were only practicing maybe a couple of hours a day and they could find that time. So he said, give me a call back in 3 days. This is before the internet. This is before cell phones. And I called him back 3 days later, and I expected to get some lip service from him that, you know, I spoke to Mr. Steinbrenner, but we really can't accommodate your requests. But I was very surprised when he said, Bill, I wish I had your telephone number. Because I called Mr. Steinbrenner. He says, whatever they want, they get.
Wow.
So I was able to arrange for 500 tickets for the crew.
Wow.
I was able to, the Yankees came out to the ship. I gave a tour. We had lunch in our Admiral's cabin. And I guess this is a life lesson right here, is that the night that of the game, I actually asked Mr. Steinbrenner, how do you get in this industry? And I was not interested in getting out of the Navy. I was just curious. And he offered me a job right on the spot, gave me his home telephone number, says, call me, I want to hire you. And I was shocked, but I realized he watched me while I was giving the tour. And I was the VIP tour coordinator on board the John F. Kennedy. So I knew exactly what to do and how to do it. And I realized he was watching me. So I guess a life lesson out of that is you never know who's watching. So I had to make a very difficult decision. I really, really loved what I was doing in the Navy. And I guess anytime I had to make a life-changing decision, you know, for example, getting married, you know, changing jobs, I would break out the legal pad, had a pros column and a cons column. And I would write down everything that was, you know, that was favorable or, you know, something that may not be favorable. And it always came down to the very bottom. Would I regret doing it or would I not regret doing it? And I'm a big believer in that when the Lord finally calls you up to wherever, hopefully heaven, that you're not laid in your deathbed and say, boy, I wish I would have done something.
Mm-hmm.
And so that always helps me with a very important decision is, would I regret doing or not doing it? In this case, I knew I could stay in the Naval Reserves. I knew I could still make a difference in the United States Navy. And I could pursue a dream of working in professional sports. So I made the decision. Stop wearing the uniform every day, although I got the chance to wear the uniform when I was in reserves, and make that transition to the civilian world and work for the New York Yankees.
Yeah. Now, how did working in the Navy prepare you for the regiment of Mr. Steinbrenner?
Well, it prepared me very well. You know, maybe a lot of people listening may not know who Mr. Steinbrenner is. And, you know, I teach this graduate course at Columbia University. And one of the first questions I ask the students is, do you know who Mr. George M. Steinbrenner III is? And they go, yeah, he's on Seinfeld. Well, that's not the answer I'm looking for. And I knew it. So that's actually the first assignment they have is to Google him, you know, read about him, and understand that he was probably the most dynamic owner in history of professional sports. Mr. Steinbrenner was very demanding. He had spent 1 year in the military, and he felt like he served the whole career in the military. While he would talk to the other members of the front office in civilian terms, military terms, like, you know, squires, I could court martial you, you know, instead of fire you. So he prepared me, you know, the Navy prepared me well. You know, Navy's about discipline. It's about accountability. It's about responsibility. It's for not making excuses. When I was at Naval Academy, we learned first day, the first thing we learned is the five basic responses. And you can replace sir and ma'am, but it's yes, sir, no, sir, aye, aye, sir, I'll find out, sir, and no excuse, sir. And the last two in the civilian world, most importantly, is I'll find out and no excuse. So it prepared me well for civilian life because that's the way I lived my life up until that point in time with my training at the Naval Academy. So he was a difficult guy to work for. You know, he gave me an opportunity, and I would not be where I am today if he didn't give me that opportunity.
How has your leadership style evolved over the years? Because you went from working with the Yankees to then stadium security. So how did the experience at the Yankees also help develop you to be the leader you are within the sports industry?
Well, first I want to say, I'm not strictly security. Everybody thinks that's what I do because I do a lot of work in the as an expert witness. But when I worked for the Yankees, I was there 2 months and my boss was fired and Mr. Steinbrenner made me the interim boss. He gave me 30 days to prove myself or I was going to be gone as well. I actually slept at the stadium. I interrogated my my administrative assistant. I read everything in the office and I empowered people that I knew I needed some assistance. So I think that comes down from the Navy. We're in the armed services. We're all operators. We may specialize in some specific areas, but we all operate. So my leadership style was developed, I think, when I was really a lot younger. I mean, I was captain of a baseball team. I was always kind of a leader as I was growing up, my early ages. I was a follower as well. But the Naval Academy, it's a leadership factory. You know, at the age of 25, I was flying a $55 million airplane with 11 people on the airplane, counting on me to make sure I was doing the right thing and could take off, fly a 10-hour mission, get back and get back safely. And, you know, I cared about my crew. I learned early on that you're only as good as your people are going to allow you to be. And if you're honest with them, you're direct, you're firm but fair, and you get to know a little bit about them, about their backgrounds, their families, where they're from, what their interests are, you know, you're investing some time to really, you know, understand people. And I think it's done great things for me. I'm not a networker. I don't go to meetings or conferences or stuff to network. I go there to meet people. I just love people. And I enjoy meeting them. And you know, my kids used to get upset with me when we'd go out to dinner because I'd always ask the waitress or the server, you know, where they're from, are they in college, where they majoring, where their plans are. And my kids say, Dad, why do you ask all these questions? I said, well, first of all, I'm interested. And second of all, you know, they're providing a service to me. I want to show them that I'm interested in them. So I've always been a people person. I lead by example. I think one of the things I pride myself in is I can make a decision. I don't always make the right decision, but when I have enough information and I ask others what their opinions are, I can make a decision. Leadership for me is, I think, comes quite naturally. I love leading people. So that's how I was able to deal with Mr. Steinbrenner because I was on a John F. Kennedy. We had a peacetime cruise. We lost 4 airplanes and 8 people were killed. Now that's real life. Mr. Steinbrenner would get upset if he saw peanut shells underneath the seat, you know, 8 games into a 10-game homestand. And I understood it was important to make sure those peanut shells are cleaned up, but I also was able to put it in perspective with real life situations. So, and when I left the Yankees, we're friendly. You know, the man made a significant difference in my life. And I'll always be grateful for that.
What would you say is one of the biggest myths students have now who want to work in the sports industry? And how do you help them understand the reality of the industry or business?
Well, I'm hoping that they've done their homework before they get to me because, you know, I teach the graduate class in sports facilities, event management. So they've had their undergrad, sometimes a little older, you know, late 20s, early 30s. There's a lot of competition out there. There's, I think the last time I looked, there's like 430 schools that have an undergraduate program or graduate program or even a PhD program. So the competition is absolutely fierce. And I've had many people come to me and I ask them what their goals are. They go, I want to work for the New York Yankees. Well, that's kind of an unrealistic goal. After I tell you my story, it sounds crazy, but, you know, I encourage them to apply to all different sports you know, if they're not willing to move, I think they're really reducing their chances to get a job in the industry. And it's not just about the stick and ball sports. You know, it's not the hockey, basketball, football, baseball, but it's, you know, minor leagues, it's racing, it's horse racing, NASCAR, it's colleges, universities, it's working for sponsors that have events related departments or divisions. So there's a lot of opportunities if you look out there, but it's not easy. You know, I think you know that as well. It's just not that easy. But, you know, the one thing that kind of is not challenged, but I guess a pet peeve in my class is that I tell the students day one that I'm going to give them 100%. And I do. And I expect the same from them. And I don't always get that 100%. I know what they're spending on the course. If I had that kind of money just to come and show up and really not invest myself, I'd probably be a pretty wealthy guy. But, you know, I expect people to work hard. And I've always worked hard in my life. I think that, you know, once again, I think people see that and recognize, and that's why I'm probably where I am today.
What I liked what you just said about showing up to meetings, it's not about networking for you. It's about getting to know the person. And we've known each other now for 10 years. And you bring that to every time we meet. You are always asking those questions mm-hmm. about me and life, and then, you know, vice versa. I want to know about you. So how, for leadership, how is that so critical, and how has that helped you surround yourself with those people that you know you can count on?
Well, listen, we're human beings. I think maybe I should, you know, share with you, you know, my story about with COVID. You know, I had COVID really bad in March of 2020. I was in a hospital for 48 days. I was on a ventilator for 32 days. I had to go to rehab to learn how to walk, brush my teeth, you know, put my pants on, you know, some unique things that, you know, you learn as when you're 5 years old. But what I learned from that experience was, I know that I survived because of the prayers and the support that I have from my friends. And that's when I realized, you know, how important friendship was to me, because I know they got me through that. It was, and God, obviously, but it wasn't anything I did. So I think that that belief in getting to know people and showing an interest, you know, not just going through the motions. It's kind of like, you know, you ever talk to somebody and you're talking to them, looking over your shoulder, looking at everything else, but not looking you in the eyes. You know, I can't stand that. I don't like that. I want people to, because I invest, I'll look them right in the eye and mm-hmm. I'll talk to them. And it's, listen, you know, I've met a lot of people in my lifetime. I'm hoping that 90% of them like me and respect me. You know, it's 10% that you'll never get through to, and that's okay. Don't focus on those who don't. Focus on those who do. And I used to joke about, you know, I didn't need any more friends, but I just couldn't get any more tickets for people. but now, after knowing what I went through, I want as many true friends as I can get, because they make a difference in my life. And, yeah. I never thought these friendships and these relationships that I built would one day save my life. But I've always been that way. I wasn't taught that as a kid. I was just always interested in people. You know, I thank God that I am. I mean, even when I go to, you know, Dunkin' Donuts, I ask questions, you know, of people, as long as I'm not holding up the line, but I'm just interested. And I tell you what, when I go to Dunkin' Donuts and they see me, they say hello to me. You know, you can see they're interested in taking care of me, because I'm just not a customer. I'm somebody who cared about that, you know, in some way, shape, or form. So I think that's a good life lesson, is that, you know, being nice is easy. And what I found out, being nice is one of the most selfish things you can do, because after a while you find out you get more out of being nice than the individual you're being nice to. Yeah. It's a selfish, but it's great. I mean, two people benefit from it. So, but I can also be very direct. You know, I can't say rough around the edges, but, you know, if I want something done, I'm going to make sure that the individual understands what I want. You know, I'm not afraid to call a student the day after a class when I caught them texting in class. I won't embarrass them in front of the class, but I'm going to make sure that they know what my expectations are. So, you know, I'm black and white. There's no gray area with me.
No. And I believe I shared this story with you. If not, I would like to share it here on the podcast, but you just talking about being direct, I credit you to how I rebranded myself after I graduated from Columbia. I don't know if you remember, we were at some alumni event, and there was a bunch of us standing in a circle, and you and I were in that circle, and someone came up, they introduced themselves, and I just said, "Hi, I'm Cheryl. I do sports marketing and events." And you literally cut me off and you said, "No, what did you just come off of?" And I said, "Well, I just came off of the Super Bowl. I served on the host committee and then the NFL committee for 2 years when the Super Bowl was hosted in New York, New Jersey." And you said, "Now reintroduce yourself. Who are you?" And you made me say it with confidence. And I said, "I'm Cheryl, and I just came off of the 2014 New York, New Jersey Super Bowl." And right there, it was such a learning lesson, because it is about how you present yourself. It did make people more interested in who I was and the value that I could bring to the table. And I always credit you for that. And ever since that moment, I introduce myself completely different now based off of the most current project that I just came off of. So if I haven't shared that with you, I would like to thank you here on the podcast, because that really changed my life, because people are more interested now in who I am and they can see right off the bat the value that I bring to the table. And that's what you instill in your students. So thank you on behalf of all of your former students.
Well, I thank you for that. It's funny. I can always remember the dumb things I've done. I don't remember many of the good things that I've done, but that's true. You know, it's like when people ask me what I do for a living, and I tell them I work in the world of sports, but I also make sure I also tell them I was in the Navy, because you know, what I do now is fun. I think what I did before was important. And to be able to say in your lifetime that you've done something that's been you just dreamt about as a little kid, but also you've done something that, you know, not many people have done, and that's put the uniform on and serve your country. So I'm not a complex person, but I make sure they know that I served my country. And you know, I don't remember actually doing that, but that sounds like something I would do, because you know, I graduated from Columbia and I'm in marketing. Well, what does that tell me? It tells me very little.
It's boring.
Now you say, I just worked 2 years for the Super Bowl. Whoa.
Yeah.
Now they're not looking over your shoulder anymore. They want to look you in the eyes and hear what you have to say.
Exactly.
You know, and it's not bragging. It's just, you know, you branded yourself. It's confidence and it's an attention getter.
Yeah. And it shows the value that you bring to the table. And that was such a huge life lesson. And I tell everyone that story. So thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad to share that with me. You know, I try and make a difference in somebody's life every single day. And you just made a difference in my life today by telling me that story. When we get done here, I'm going to go out for my daily 5 to 7 mile walk. And I'll be thinking about that a lot, because it means, boom, checking a box. I did something for somebody and that was nice. And I get a lot out of it, because it makes me feel good.
Yeah. Now, if you're comfortable sharing, would you like to talk about the work that you do for cystic fibrosis?
Sure. I have a child, son. My son says a child. He's 25 years old. His name is Sean, S-E-A-N, who was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis at the age of 5. It's a life-threatening genetic disease. And my wife and I, as soon as we found out he was diagnosed with it, researched it, figured out, okay, what do we do? So my wife became the medical, the doctor, the nurse, the therapist, and I became the fundraiser. And so, you know, over the past 20 years, my son's on a new drug that's a result of all the fundraising that the foundation does. My family and I are responsible for probably raising about $4 million for the cause. He's taking a drug that's called Trikafta. It's improved his quality of life. And since he was diagnosed, the life expectancy at that time was 34. Now it's 53. So it's not only physically he's improved, but you know, I've always worried about the mental aspect of it, because he had to dedicate so much of his time to therapy and taking care of himself. And now there's some things, he's got more free time to do things that he really loves. So it's important. And right now I'm the president of the New Jersey chapter of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. I've been trying to avoid that for years, but my executive director finally wore me down. So I just began that in January. which means it's, you know, another job, but it's, you know, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it 100%. But we're making a difference. And, you know, my family and I will not quit raising awareness for money until everybody, there's many, many different mutations of the disease out there that, but until everybody has a cure. And I'm hoping that I live long enough to see that day, because that'll be absolutely terrific.
How were you able to mentally deal with that when he was first diagnosed?
It was really difficult. And I'll tell you what really did it for me. You know, you start reading numbers, 30,000 people, life expectancies, you know, what the daily treatment is, and possible double lung transplants, becoming diabetic, not being able to father children naturally. There's a lot of things that come along with it. But when we bought our house in 2000, we bought it from a family who had lost a daughter to a respiratory ailment. And 2 years later, Sean was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis. And my wife shared that news with a neighbor across the street who was a nurse. And the neighbor across the street, she said, "My God, you know, the people you bought the house from, their daughter died of cystic fibrosis." So at that point in time, there were only about 500 people in the state of New Jersey that had CF. So what are the chances that we would buy a house from somebody who lost a child to cystic fibrosis? The chances are, you know, astronomical. So I realized then that God chose us, you know, and they chose us because they knew the loving mother that Jody was, that how she would take care of Sean and our daughter, Sydney. And they knew that, and he knew that I had the drive and determination and had all these friends that I had made over the years, you know, for childhood friends, Navy friends, civilian friends, and that they would support my cause. And they have, and they continue to do so. So, and we see a difference, you know, when it goes from 34 to 53, that's a pretty good thing. We expect that number to keep going up and to see, you know, Sean flourish and grow, and he doesn't let cystic fibrosis define him. You know, he's living a happy life, and, you know, it's part of who he is, but it's not what he is. So I'm not a woe is me person. I didn't woe is me when she found out Sean had CF. And it wasn't woe is me when I found I almost died of COVID. You know, it's like, hey, you know, you're chosen, but still hard. But it's I can see Sean. He doesn't cough nearly as much, and you know, he smiles a lot. And I think mentally he's in a far better place.
That's so amazing.
All is good.
Yeah. What is the biggest piece of advice you would share with anyone who's looking to pivot in their career?
Well, I'm going to give you some advice that I learned from COVID first. I get asked a lot, you know, what did I learn from my experience? And I learned a lot of different things. Like, I tell people that I may look the same, I may sound the same, but I'm just not the same. And I think anybody who's had a near-death experience, you know, knows what I'm talking about. But the two things I would say is, one, live in the moment. Don't focus on tomorrow or next week, a month down the road, because, you know, tomorrow is not guaranteed. And two, attitude. If you have a good attitude, you'll have a pretty good life. If you have a bad or poor attitude, life's going to kind of suck. And that's something that's a decision an individual can make. So you have control over that. But to get into the world, or if you're going to pivot once again, you know, there's a lot of factors. Is it, you know, you got to take your family into consideration. I think you need to look at your long-term goals, but it comes down to regrets. If there's something that you think you really want to do, then you should. And you've done all your thinking, you've talked to people, if you have a mentor, you share it with your mentor and your family, and you can make that decision. But don't, you know, 10 years down the road say, hey, you know, I wish I would have done that. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to the world of sports, it's tough, but you can work in a full-time job earning a salary to pay your mortgage, your car payments, and everything else, and still pursue your dreams. You don't have to give up on your dreams, but you do have to pay the bills.
Where can my listeners find you on social media?
Man, I'm only on LinkedIn, but I'll tell you a quick story. I'm on LinkedIn and I've only posted 3 times. The first time I posted was I went back to the ICU to visit the nurses who saved my life. And I talked about mental health for the nurses and doctors who went through that terrible time. And I got 54,000 views. When I went to Super Bowl last week, I had the opportunity to take a picture after the game with the young ladies who did the flyover. There was a 4-plane flyover, and they were all female pilots and naval flight officers. And I was able to get them on the field. I was able to take a picture with them. I posted it last Monday, a week ago today, and it's already got almost 32,000 views. So I'm only on LinkedIn. I'm not on any of the other stuff. My kids run all that other stuff, Twitter and Instagram and all that other stuff, but that's it. I mean, that's the only thing I'm on.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to link to your LinkedIn so people can find you there. So,
okay, great. Yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me on this episode. I always appreciate our conversations.
Well, you've really grown. I love reading your articles. I read them every time that you write one. And to think that you've got a master's in sports and facility event management, and here you are with a PhD writing.
Yeah.
It just goes to show you anybody can make a pivot and be happy. So I appreciate you having me, Cheryl. It was a great opportunity. Thanks very much.
Thank you for joining me on this episode of Embrace the Pivot. I hope all of you have a wonderful week. And until next time, happy pivoting.
You can follow me, Dr. C, on Instagram at Embrace the Pivot. I hope all of you embrace your pivot.